from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In the 80s, it was MTV. In the 90s, it was Napster. Today, it's the Apple iPod and the cheeky software slogan, Rip, Mix, Burn. It's behind the music revolution of a new century. Cash-poor teenagers flock to Kazaa to download MP3s, and the record labels are in major trouble. Americans bought 62 million fewer CDs last year. Big-time retailers are going bankrupt, unable to compete with free music downloads. It's an industry on the verge of a revolution or a collapse. The question of the hour is, does the music industry, as we've known it, die with the CD? Many now say yes. Some say good riddance. But what about the music? We're talking this hour about the death of the CD and the future of the music industry, what it means for record companies and retailers, for musicians, and for you. Is it time for CDs to go the way of the LP and the 8-track? Are you ready to grab all your music from the ether? Will you pay for it? And what will we hear and how will we hear it if the major labels go away? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Amherst, Massachusetts, is Charles Mann, a correspondent with the Atlantic Monthly. His article in the February issue of Wired magazine is The Year the Music Dies. Good evening and welcome, Charles Mann.
Hello.
Hi, thanks for joining us tonight. You've been writing about this for a long time, and it hasn't gotten any better. How you say in your Wired article, Charles Mann, that this year could determine whether the music business as we know it survives. How bad is it?
Well, the mood among the music people that I know and have spoken to is pretty sepulchral. I think that they're seeing, you know, reality is finally kicking in, and they're seeing that they're going to have to go through a kind of revolution in what they do to survive, and it's not at all clear that they can do it.
Why wouldn't they be up to it? There's major dollars on the line here. Why wouldn't the music business just roll ahead? They certainly rolled right on from LPs and right on from 8-track tapes.
Well, there's a couple reasons. First, in this case, they're competing with Kazaa, Morpheus, iMesh, and a whole bunch of file swapping communities in which basically the same music that they want to sell is available for free. And that's it's pretty tough to compete with free.
Yes, it is.
The second thing is that they've had real trouble setting up their online services for a variety of legal and technological reasons. And in fact, now they're in the paradoxical situation, which is often easier to get music illicitly than it is licitly.
You mean easier because you can just go to the web and pull it down, or because the web is easier than driving to a music retailer? Why easier?
It's in all those cases. If you want to, say, hit that one Temptation song that you remember from your youth, or want to play it for your child or what have you, if you go to the record store, chances are pretty good that they won't have it. You have to drive out there. You can't get the one song that you want because the single doesn't exist anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't get it, more than likely, online because the Temptations probably haven't signed their contracts to get it online. But you can go on Kazaa and probably pull it right off the air in a few minutes if you have a high-speed internet connection.
But there's a bigger cultural and technological context here than just Kazaa and downloading from the internet that you write about, Charles Mann. Paint that picture for us. What are all the pressures that are coming to bear on CD sales today? They're way down. What we read, that 62 million fewer sold last year than the year before, while blank CDs are going way up. What are the forces arrayed against the success of music CDs now?
Well, what happened in the 1980s was that as the CD came in, the music industry did what you might call kind of a bait and switch, which is they played the singles on the air and people wanted to get them, but they took away the single itself. So you more or less had to buy the CD to get what you wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And this drove sales of CDs enormously. In addition, people replaced all their LPs with CDs, a process that went on for, you know, 10, 12 years.
Yes.
Now what's happened is at once both of these have disappeared. People have already replaced all their LPs with CDs, and they've done it for some years now. And on all these online services, you can get just the single you want. You can get the one or two songs you want and not have to pay the $15 or $12 or $11 or whatever it is that's going to be charged in your retailer. Now, I'm not for a minute saying that that's a legal thing to do, but it is certainly the case that 3 or 4 million people are logged on to Kazaa to just pick one every minute of the day.
And I read that something like 3 billion downloads are going on per month these days.
Oh, I'm sure that's the case. And, in fact, if you add in all the different ways that people can exchange their music, I'm sure the figure is actually much higher.
But downloading is not the only thing here. I mean, as we look out on this horizon, you've got an economy that's not great. You've got competition from other forms of entertainment.
Right. In the 1980s, people didn't have PlayStations. You know, what the competition for teenagers' attention is just enormous right now. And, you know, music is being sidelined along with practically everything else by the enormous onslaught of the Internet and video games.
And then I guess there's also a narrower range of music being played on radio, so people are not being introduced to as much new music.
Yes. What you have, and this is also something that's not a friend to the music industry, is there's essentially two large conglomerates, Clear Channel and Infinity, that control a very large percentage of the radio stations in the country, and they play the same music on every, or virtually the same music on most of their stations. So as a result, you have more and more of a kind of a blockbuster syndrome where, you know, a small number of artists get played endlessly. The problem is that this used to be actually quite good for the industry because they could focus all their attention and sell the Beatles or sell the Rolling Stones or whoever.
Go Michael Jackson.
Or Michael Jackson, mm-hmm. Right. You know, and on, you could just Nirvana, you can just mm-hmm. Go up the decades. What's happened is those are the guys who are the first grab now on these file sharing units. And so the most profitable artists are the ones that they're losing the most money on.
Because everyone is grabbing those right. very names
those
right,
very
right
names.
Off the web.
Whereas the relatively obscure mid-list guys are harder to find on the file shopping networks, but then you can't hear them. You can't hear their music practically anywhere unless you're within realm reach of a college station or sometimes an NPR station.
So we feel, I guess very widely, a kind of ambivalence about the labels themselves, and we'll talk about that. But if they're to survive, which is the heart of the music business as we've known it surviving, what does this industry have to do?
Well, they're going to have to do a whole bunch of things, and all of which are difficult, and to do all of them together is going to be enormously hard.
Give us the checklist.
Yeah. Well, one of the checklists would be certainly be find a way to greatly slow down file sharing. At the same time, they're going to have to come up with a way to make money selling music online.
In other words, stop the illegal file sharing. But
and provide a legal alternative.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Both of those are very tall orders.
Yes, I'd say.
Another thing they're going to have to do is make peace with their artists. It's pretty clear that the current system in which they essentially trade copyright, in which the artists trade copyright to the labels in return for and get to keep all the concert receipts, but none of the record receipts, which is more or less the way it works. Mm-hmm. That's a very crude summary of it, but it's not too far off. Isn't going to work anymore. And the one possibility is for the record labels to act more like traditional venture capitalists and say to the band, okay, we'll back you in return for, you know, a certain percentage of all your proceeds, including the touring records. In other words, they have to completely restructure the kind of contractual way that they do business.
Which would be an incentive then for musicians to slash their recording costs.
Right, and to also slash a whole bunch of the ancillary costs that now are kind of billed to the labels in the expectation that they'll be picked up by earnings from the CDs themselves.
So they've got to stop illegal downloading, provide their own for-profit online sales, maybe allow in-store CD burning as well.
Yes, that was another thing. If you go to the Rock and Roll Museum in Cleveland, mm-hmm. one of the neatest features they have there is a kind of a jukebox with, I think it's 30,000 songs, and you can make your own mix CD right there on the spot. And I think if they're able to have that in record stores, that would be a powerful incentive to bring people to the stores. Maybe they might buy some CDs while they're at it.
Mm-hmm. And as you point out, they're doing it already off the web. You came on at 10 a.m. on a Monday morning and found 3.1 million people at work on the Kazaa network. So that is huge traffic. I guess, Charles Mann, there's so many pieces to this puzzle, but one big question at the end of it all is, what does it matter to musicians and to music lovers, to listeners, if the big labels survive or not?
Well, that's a very complicated question, mm-hmm. and I think you could break it up into two ways. One is that the music labels do bankroll a lot of the recordings that people love, and so without some system to bankroll this, you know, you're going to lose a lot of wonderful records.
Bankroll by that, do you mean getting the bands off the ground to begin with?
Well, okay, yes, there's two ways that they do that. One is by literally paying for the studio time. Now, that's actually getting to be less and less important as the technology makes recording CDs cheaper and cheaper, but it's still not.
Though we should note that you point out that Michael Jackson spent $30 million on studio time for his latest album.
Well, that's the claim, which is a ridiculous thing. But you still, it does cost, if you want to get people who really know what they're doing, it does cost, you know, $100,000 or so to really get excellent sound. Now, that's way down from what it used to be.
Yep.
And and now more or less you can get pretty good results by simply recording it on your iMac.
But if the labels aren't there to put out the capital to begin with, you're saying we may never hear these recordings.
Some of it. Some people will be able to bankroll themselves. The other thing that the labels do is that they do have a pool of guys who have experience in helping musicians, you know, achieve their visions. And in the pop area, you know, there's these people are extremely famous. You know, George Martin with the Beatles, in the '60s is an example probably most of your listeners know. But and today you have Timbaland and the Neptunes working with the hip hop people. In fact, working with a whole bunch of genres. There's a whole lot of you have Clive Davis. There's a whole lot of these people who have really, you know, the suits who have contributed an enormous amount to music in our time.
So is the suggestion there that without the big labels, the whole industry fractures and you've got kind of a cottage industry, each band on its own little local legs, not achieving the kind of national or global exposure?
Yeah, and, you know, in some ways that's not bad. You might get more middle-class living, more middle-class artists, you know, artists who make a decent living but don't make, who aren't global superstars. And you trade that so you wouldn't have, you know, Michael Jackson's in the future.
Given the kind of huge dominance of a few so-so acts, the idea of locally successful musicians marketing themselves on the web sounds kind of appealing. Sounds like a much more varied musical diet than we've had recently.
Yeah, it could be much more varied, and that would be the best, you know, possible outcome of this. If the, you know, the best possible outcome of the record industry collapsing, of course you could end up with, you know, utter confusion and practically nothing happening, you know, the system just sort of being wrecked without much taking its place.
We're talking about the future of the CD and the music industry. Will they both die? Will they both die in the next year? Joe's calling from Milwaukee. Hi, Joe. You're on the air.
Hi. I guess I just wanted to say that although you've already covered some of the points, it's never made quite clear enough, in my opinion, that when people download music of the artist that they love, they are stealing from those artists. And they are putting them, the very musicians that they care for so much, out of business.
So, Joe, we read that that 3 billion people a month are doing it on one website or on a handful. How do you stop that kind of volume?
Well, I guess I just never hear, like, the record industry or the artists coming out and promoting the fact, you know, getting the artist to say, for God's sakes, do you understand that you're putting us out of business?
Joe, you're a musician?
I am. And that's, they're not just putting the big-time people out of business. They're putting people like myself and studios who, you know, are out of business as well.
So do you blame the downloaders, Joe, or do you blame the labels for not being more aggressive in getting for-pay services online that might attract users?
Well, that's the thing is that, I mean, as I understand it, kids today simply believe that music is theirs to have for free. That is the attitude that they have about it. They don't believe that it has a value. They believe at this point that they can download it for free, and that's the way it should be.
And the industry may be dying. Joe, thanks for calling, Charles Mann. We've just got a minute here. But is there a way to save an industry when a whole generation believes its product is and should be free?
Well, I don't think the industry actually believes that the industry should be free.
I mean the downloaders, the users.
No, I think that they all regard this as a good thing while they can get it, while the getting is good.
Right.
But I don't think they actually believe that it should be free.
So you think that this generation and everybody who's downloaded can be turned around and turned into good customers?
Well, I think it right now it's so incredibly easy to take what you want and to look at it, you know, and it's so hard to experience it other ways. Remember, one of the ways that radio used to work is, oh, Willie Nelson just released an album, and say,
yep,
I'm a Willie Nelson fan, and I might want, and it's an album of cuts he made in the 60s, and I might want to hear some of it. I can't hear it on the radio. If I have a chance to hear it, I might want to buy it. But in fact, the only way I'm probably going to hear it is if I go on Kazaa and download a few cuts.
It's online. We're going to take a short break, Charles Mann. We're talking about the death of the music CD, maybe the industry. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
From Boston,
Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking tonight about the death of the music CD and maybe the music industry as we've known it. What do you think? Do you still buy CDs? Do you think you will in a year, in 2 years, for music? Do you turn to your stereo or your computer, to a music store or to Kazaa? And LPs and 8-track tapes went away. Does it matter if CDs go away as well? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been talking with Charles Mann, author of an article in the February issue of Wired Magazine, The Year the Music Dies, and this could be that year, says Charles Mann. We're joined now by John Snyder from Greensboro, North Carolina. He's president of Artists House, an independent record label, been in the industry for 30 years, a 32-time Grammy nominee, and a board member on the National Association of Recording Arts and Sciences. Good evening and welcome, John Snyder.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for being with us, John. Charles Mann puts things in pretty dire terms, that the industry is dying and could be dead within the year. Is it that bad?
Well, you know, I don't think it's dying. I think it's changing. I don't think that, I think that with the advent of the internet and that much music, 33 billion downloads in 1 month means there's more music in the air than ever before. And I think there's a lot of opportunity for that.
You've written, John Snyder, that the music industry ought to embrace this file sharing. How should it do that? And is it capable culturally and in economic terms of doing so?
I don't think that it's culturally capable of doing it, but I think that they should do it. And I would point out that music is free on radio right now. I mean, it's not a question of free music. It's a question of what the effect of listening to it is. On the internet, it's a matter of choice, it's just a difference between radio and internet is a matter of choice, it seems to me. And with the control of radio by several companies, it does eliminate a lot of music. And I think people are just making different choices.
Charles Mann, give us the upside and downside pictures here. If the labels should go away, if they don't make the leap that John Snyder says they should, and they go away, what's the upside for listeners? What's the downside for the world?
Well, the problem is that the system now doesn't work very well for the tremendous majority of musicians. You know, they don't make much money out of it, so they have actually relatively little to lose from the collapse of the labels.
Except we all imagine that they would make nothing at all if everything is downloaded, that they'd have to empty the garage of Bentleys and get a job.
Well,
9 to 5.
Most of them don't have Bentleys. I mean, you know, music is not that kind of business. But certain musicians certainly have the opportunity to make money while performing and to make money doing other things in addition to selling CDs. And presumably those things would still be there. The question would be how much money they could make from CDs, which for, I think, the majority of musicians isn't actually all that much right now.
Mm-hmm. John Snyder, how about it? That seems to paint a picture of a future where musicians make their money by touring. Could be a lot of time on the road.
I think that touring is the best way to do it. I think music is local, and I think that artists, with the advent of MIDI, everybody is capable of being an artist, and the internet has made everybody a possible distributor. The only thing that's really threatened here is the conglomerate control over distribution channels. And let's not forget that AOL, which is the major ISP in this country, owns Warner Brothers Records. So the very copyrights that are being threatened by one of their divisions are being profitable to another division. And all the major conglomerates have this same sort of conflict.
That's a very interesting point, John Snyder. Charles Mann, let me put it to you. You've written of how few friends the music industry has. Describe that kind of necklace of others who just don't give a darn.
Well, you have the fans who don't like the labels, you know, who have been trained, in fact, by, you know, generations of musicians complaining about them not to like them. You have the musicians themselves who feel, often with good reason, that the contracts are draconian and unfair. You have the retailers who are increasingly unhappy with the fact that the labels, by coming up with these downloading services, are in effect going into competition with their own retailers.
Mm-hmm.
You have Congress, which doesn't like them because they, you know, sell dirty music. And you have the consumer electronics industry, which sees downloading music as a huge profit center and doesn't want to, you know, to sell iPods and MP3 players, doesn't want to see that cut off.
Because they've got all the hardware they can sell and software to underwrite it.
Right. And then you have the ISPs, the who want to sell high-speed Internet access. And one of the main reasons for people to subscribe to high-speed Internet is to trade files.
Sounds like a very lonely world for record labels. Tara is calling from Boston. Hi, Tara. You're on the air.
Hey, how are you guys?
Great, thanks.
Listen, I want to know why the record companies, and I'm saying this in a very general sense,
okay,
not to offend any of my major label friends,
okay,
why they've sort of held fast to a business model that is crumbling. And I know that that's obvious from the conversation that we're having, but just think about the value creation stream. And you think about they've sold music. That's what they do. They sell
yes.
music. And they sell it in a variety of forms. You look at the radio stations. They've said, well, gee, we have this media. Let's promote concerts. And now they're promoting concerts, and they have memberships, and you can meet stars, and you can do all kinds of funky things.
So are you saying, Tara, that they should let go of making money on individually packaged baskets of music that we now call CDs?
No, say that's one thing we do in amongst the many others. We are trying to promote artists in this checklist of ways, these 100 ways, and selling the records in a hard jewel case is one.
Well, let's take it up with our guys here. Tara, thanks for your call. John Snyder, how about it? Can you describe the cultural problem? But Tara says, come on, if their life is on the line, they need to change. Can they? Will they? What would you have the labels do to change?
I think they need to offer more service for less money. If you look at Amazon, they just had their biggest quarter by expanding their product lines to include clothing and cutting the cost by shipping things for free of orders over $25.
So CDs are too expensive.
They're too expensive for sure, but you know, there's a lot of competition for the, as you mentioned earlier, for the CD dollar. I mean, with the advent of DVD, the fastest growing home electronics medium ever introduced, mm-hmm. video games, a $6 billion business last year, cell phones, internet usage is up 2,000% in the last 5 or 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of things going on, and it's not necessarily true that downloading is the only problem facing the music business. I think there's a lot of competition, and I think that the cost of buying music in the retail stores is too great for too little.
Mm.
My company, I'm including DVDs in my packages for the same price as the CD, just to give more to the consumer, to bring them into the creative process.
This is a DVD that has video of the band and the creation of the CD kind of thing?
That's right. The recording session is 3 or 4 hours of content on there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, music has been treated as a commodity by the major companies, and now the public is treating it as that too. Well, let's bring it back to what it is, an art form that can affect people's lives in a positive way.
Can these major labels have the revenue stream from that kind of buffet of smaller, less expensive offerings that they have historically had from the LP, from the 8-track, from the CD?
Right.
Well, do you think they can? Can they have the same kind of money?
They're going to have to change the way they look at things. I think the future of music is multimedia. I think the future of multimedia is DVD. I think the future of the record companies is to be software companies. I don't think they know that yet.
Well, we're talking about a big change here. Let's just pick off one piece of that, Charles Mann. You write that when the labels tried to get together to sell music online, they essentially flopped, that their online music services put together attracted fewer paying customers than the single McDonald's in Times Square, New York.
Right. Well, there's a couple of reasons for that. One is that the technical infrastructure necessary to do what they want to do, which is to essentially give you streams of music,
mm-hmm.
so that you would click on and then it would beam you the music, and kind of like having your own private radio station that you're programming.
And I'd pay something for each beaming?
Pardon?
And I'd pay something every time I did that?
Well, you'd pay, you know, on the
or order subscription.
$10 a month,
mm-hmm.
and then you'd get to select a menu of songs, and you could say, stack up a bunch of songs and play them.
Is that really so hard? It sounds quite possible.
Oh, it is quite possible, but I don't know if you've ever, say, tried to listen to some video or to watch a video on the net or to, you know, listen to one of your, you know, NPR programs on the net.
Mm-hmm, sure.
You know how it skips a little bit?
Yeah, you got that hiccup in the stream.
Right. Well, this is because sending out a continuous stream of music or video images or what have you to tens of thousands or, you know, people simultaneously is a ferociously difficult technological feat. If you're sending out a file that they can play later, then you can send it out in the skips and the jumps and so forth. Don't matter.
But why not just do that? Why not just send out the file? It certainly it's worked for Kazaa.
What they're afraid of is that people will get the file and then simply trade it. Mm-hmm. It'll go on Kazaa and that'll be that.
So this is
what they want. So there's a real technological difficulty in it. The second thing is that a lot of the reasons that it failed is that a lot of the artists that people most want to hear have not been in those systems, precisely because to do this requires renegotiating a whole bunch of contracts.
Mm-hmm.
And the artists who people most want to hear typically have held out for more money.
You say it may take a couple of years to work out all those kinks, and they may not have that long. Charles Mann, John Snyder, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Mike Dries. He's CEO and co-founder of Newbury Comics, a major New England music and pop culture retailer. Good evening and welcome, Mike Dries.
Good evening.
Thanks for being with us. Mike, you've sold a lot of CDs in your time. You've still got a lot of CDs in your stores. Do you see that business going away?
The business is going away at a fairly rapid pace. We ourselves are seeing about maybe a 15% comparable store decline in CD sales for the second year in a row now. So a typical Newbury Comics store is selling about 20 to 25% fewer CDs than it did 2 years ago at this time.
That's a big drop. Now your stores sell a lot more than CDs, but you have been one of the very kinds of outlets we've talked about. You've helped give exposure to CDs. You've done marketing. You've been out there. Are you willing, as a retailer, to stay in the game with sales crumbling like that?
Well, we'll be in the game as one of the last dominoes to fall. We're very strong in our markets and whatnot, but one element I do want to bring in here is that one of the things we've championed is developing artists over the years, and what the industry is losing through the market share shifts that are occurring, which are quite dramatic, meaning mass merchants last year were just about neutral, where regular specialist shops were down about 15%. So you're seeing a huge shift in market share.
So you're kind of Walmarts are selling
Walmart
a lot.
And Target stores are gaining huge amounts of market share at the expense of mom and pop and specialist chains.
What's the impact of that, Mike?
It has a huge implication in the sense that a Target or Walmart typically will only stock 1,500 to 1,800 different titles. And in general, they will not bring in a title unless the national initial order on that title is in the 40 to 60,000 unit range.
And you've talked about that, among other things, producing a kind of artistic constipation, not enough variety. But is that going to be solved by brick-and-mortar retailers like you, or are you willing to somehow work with the Internet? What's your vision?
I don't think that the vast bulk of brick-and-mortar has any place on the Internet. I mean, I think that's going to be a world dominated by the players that currently dominate it, whether it's AOL or Verizon, or it's going to be a wireless big-time venture to market that service. It's something that most retailers, particularly mom-and-pop retailers, are absolutely ill-equipped to engage in.
So you
they don't have the brand power
mm-hmm.
to get their message across to consumers. You see full-page ad after full-page ad trying to sell you cellular phone services. That's the way these services will emerge, and it's the regional or the five-store chain or the 20-store chain is going to have very little marketing leverage in that world.
So as a retailer, you don't see much of a future there for yourself. But as a music listener, a music lover, do you look forward to this web-based music era or not?
Yeah, I think it's going to be quite amazing. I think the thing that saddens me is that the industry is increasingly being driven by alternative revenue. It's what I call the Tiger Woods effect, where there was an article in the Wall Street Journal maybe 4 or 5 months ago mm-hmm. saying Tiger Woods was going to be the first individual in human history to get over $1 billion in licensing endorsements. The Rolling Stones and Aerosmith, everybody else, are going down the same path. So what we're seeing is major packaged goods companies having a great need for viable brands to attach otherwise mediocre products to. So
we're not talking just T-shirts anymore. We're talking a whole range of things with artist branding.
We're talking, I was just down in Orlando yesterday, and there's the Aerosmith roller coaster ride at MGM Studio Park. So, the ancillary income that these brands are creating now are enormous, and that's one reason why I think these large brands will not go away. It takes enormous muscle to get the brands out there, and the new model out there that EMI recently pursued with their Robbie Williams contract is to try to step in the place of being the brand marketer, so to speak, so that they're gaining access to ancillary revenues, meaning
we've
like your concert
yep.
revenue.
And but we don't want branded teddy bears. We want great music, and we know you do too, Mike Dries. Stand by. John's calling from Boston. Hi, John. You're on
Hi,
the air.
Everybody. Hi. I'm more comfortable with the fact of having a library of hard copy CDs, because I feel the digital format, i.e. something downloaded onto your hard drive, is a little more fallible.
You like it right there, stacked in the jewel cases on your shelf.
Yes, and it can make the mixes on my own. I just, you know, the MP3 format, it can be lost just if there's an accident with your computer or whatnot. So that's one point. But,
but there are millions of people, John, who are not holding up for a minute because of that.
I'm sorry, I don't understand.
Well, they're going to the web. They're using it. They're apparently satisfied
with
it.
Agreed, but it can be lost.
So why don't you think they go to CDs?
Well, I'm not entirely sure, quite honestly. I'm just talking from my perspective. Mm-hmm. I'm a lot more comfortable with having a library of hard copies. Just like not everybody's a strong reader, but having a library of books.
So are you buying fewer? Are you part of the downturn, John?
No, not necessarily. I actually don't. I feel more comfortable buying CDs than I do constantly upgrading my computer.
And how about the price of CDs? Is that any drag
on
you?
The other thing I wanted to comment on. First of all, I want to thank Newbery Comics for having reasonable CD prices, even for the new
thank
releases.
You.
Hey, there's a hats off to Mike.
Yeah,
please.
Definitely. But I would like people to comment on that, all of your guests, because it's my understanding that the markup is just ignoring it compared to the production cost of a CD.
Got it. Let me put it to him. Thanks for your call, John. Mike Reese will go first to you. We understand that the average CD costs $14 plus now. Does it have to be that high?
No, it doesn't. In fact, you're seeing developing artists in particular come out at very low price points. The manufacturer is now charging us typically between maybe $6 and $7.50 for a large array of developing artists, so those are able to be priced at $7, $8, $9, $99. The industry, you know, gets that part of the message. It some of the artists, in essence, don't get the other part of the message, that just because you're ZZ Top, it doesn't mean that you can charge $17.98 list, which would in our store sell for, say, $15.99, just because you're ZZ Top and it's your seventh best album.
John Snyder, let me put that to you. Can you see CD prices coming down by nearly half? Is that a way to keep the party going?
You know, there's so many people that get a cut of that. It's, I myself am wrestling with the problem of paying for the manufacturing cost, the mechanical royalties, the artist royalties, the paying back the cost of creating and recording the product. It's, there's a lot of expenses involved in making it. It does need to come down, but, and I'm sure that there is a trend, I think, towards that. Like, it was mentioned that the emerging artists. But, you know, let's not forget that MP3s are highly compressed formats. It's almost like junk food music. You can't...
It's not the same depth and richness there.
Yeah, it's only 4 bits. I mean, I think that that there's a lot to be said for, like one of your callers said, that holding that thing in their hand, you know, there's value in it.
And yet the numbers are down. John Snyder, stand by. We have to take a short break. Mike Dries, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Mike Dries is CEO and co-founder of Newbery Comics. We're talking about the death of the music CD and maybe the music industry as we know it. Is something more than technology changing here? Are we changing the way we listen, our relationships with artists? Do we want straight music anymore? Or does it have to have a joystick and a visual to sell? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
From Boston University.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the death of the music CD and maybe the music industry as we've known it. Are you ready to download all your music? Would you, do you, pay for it online? And is something more than technology changing here? Do we want straight music anymore? Or does it have to have a joystick and a visual to sell? Will you miss Sony, EMI, Universal, Warner, BMG? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. My guests tonight are Charles Mann, author of The Year the Music Dies in the February issue of Wired magazine, and from Greensboro, North Carolina, John Snyder, president of Artist House, an independent record label. He's been in the industry for 30 years, had 32 Grammy nominations. You can join us as well. Zachary's on the air. Hi, Zachary.
Hello, Tom.
Good evening.
Good evening to you. I've just realized that this is not a new argument. I remember back in the mid-90s, in the classical music era, this was not a phenomenon that anybody got too concerned about when it came to orchestras being dropped from record contracts left and right. And now, 7 years later, Sony, BMG, Warner, they've all turned their backs. Many of the smaller classical labels closed themselves.
How could orchestras be so cool about it, Zachary?
Well, they started recording themselves. They opened up their own labels, and London Symphony, for example, has their own label, which went to Album of the Year last year for classical recordings. They've been faring pretty well. They've done their own distributions, and this could be a model for the others to look at.
Well, let us pick that up. And, Zachary, thank you for your call. Charles Mann, how widely could that be followed?
Well, there are these communities of types of music that are sort of off the pop mainstream that are pretty self-sufficient. If you go to jazz is certainly one of them. If you go, there's all these bluegrass festivals. I think there's about 2,000 in North America where people come. They have their own homemade CDs, and they provide people with a middle-class income. So there is certainly that kind of thing that's been going on now for quite some time.
But a symphony orchestra has more than just the recording sales to keep it going. It's got a whole infrastructure that supports it and a local community. Can that, would that work, John Snyder, for musicians with less of a surround of support?
Well, I think symphony orchestras are a good deal of trouble. We could even go back to the fact that music is being eliminated from the public schools.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of changes that are happening that are bumping into each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one of the issues. I think one thing we could do is start at the beginning again and try to increase the awareness of the arts and the creative enterprise and creative thinking with children.
I guess that takes us to something you mentioned before, and I wanted to ask more about the DVD phenom. DVDs are not so widely used for music, so are you saying that we've got a new generation that doesn't simply want to listen to music if it doesn't have we were playful, but if it doesn't have a joystick and a visual, it doesn't sell?
No, I'm not. But I do think that the DVD offers opportunity to create a context and to kind of personalize the artist. I mean, how do you bring the artist's personality more into the creation of the music.
But isn't the music enough? I mean, the music must be the most expressive of art forms.
I think that it's enough, but I think that the fact that you could put a visual component to the creation of it, I'm not suggesting that the music, the final record, has to have a video associated with the music. The videos that I'm producing that accompany the music are more or less documentaries of how the music was created.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lesson, like O'Teal Burbridge is one of the artists that we produce, and there's a 40-minute bass lesson with him on that DVD.
To create that bond between the listener and the artist. Stephen's calling from South Weymouth. Hi, Stephen. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm calling to tell you about, well, I'm a musician, and frankly, we're all really scared and angry about what's going on, and the fact that the industry hasn't gone away from their crumbling business model. So we've banded together and started a company where we think we're going to be the archetype of the music future. It's called CarneyDigital.com.
And what's the model? Well, how does it work? How does it make money?
We rip bands' music into MP3s, and we encrypt it for them for free. So that if you go to Carney Digital, download a song, and we'll bring back the single too, because you just download one of the songs,
okay,
or download the whole record for $7.50. 70% of that goes to the artist, 5% goes to grant-based non-for-profit. Non-for-profit.
Outfit. We've got it, Stephen. But what if I don't care about the law and I'm just as happy to go to Kazaa and do it for free?
Well, that's the thing. Musicians have to take the lead here. They have to tell people that this is wrong, that it's killing us. We can't keep doing this if all our music is just going to get ripped off. So we're encrypting it. So if you go to Carney Digital and get the music from there, you can download it onto your hard drive. But if you try to share that file, it's going to come up with a little our little logo and a polite message that says, you're not doing anything for musicians. Why don't you go give 70 cents a song to the artist.
So you're not waiting to be run over by this, Stephen. You and others are standing up as musicians, now turned business people as well, to say this is the way it can work. Charles Mann, do you see a way ahead there in this kind of entrepreneurial action on the part of musicians themselves?
Certainly, this is potentially a good idea. I should say that the crypto people that one talks to are a little skeptical about whether this can work, because it only takes one guy to break the crypto or to get a good copy of this to spread it out,
right.
And everybody's seen this happen time and time and time again on Kazaa. Still, there's a, sort of an open question about if you raise the bar a little bit, in the way which they're trying to do, will it nudge people to being more willing to pay? And this is still, I think, an open question.
And John Snyder, our time is short, but look down the road for us a little bit on the other side of the near horizon. Do you see a richer musical future or a poorer musical future coming to us?
I see a richer. I think there's more people putting their music on the Internet than ever. And I don't subscribe to the proposition that downloaded music is the death of the music business. Eminem's record was the most highly downloaded record of the year last year, and also the largest selling. So the movie business is more, the more downloads in the movie business than ever, but last year was the biggest year for the movie business since the 1950s.
So maybe we can have it all in Charles Mann's picture of local artists becoming more dominant, fewer great white whales, great huge celebrities, and greater variety. Sounds pretty attractive as well. We're out of time. John Snyder, I want to thank you for joining us tonight. It's been great having you.
You're welcome.
John Snyder is president of Artists House, an independent record label. He's a board member of the National Association of Recording Arts and Sciences. And Charles Mann, you've been very generous with your time and thoughts. Thank you for joining us tonight.
You're welcome.
Charles Mann is author of The Year the Music Dies in the February issue of Wired magazine. He's a correspondent with The Atlantic Monthly. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on Forums. This is On Point. Antonín Dvořák is perhaps the most famous classical composer of Czech descent. Many of his best-known pieces were written after a stay in the United States in the late 19th century, when he began to weave African and Native American musical themes into his symphonies. On Point audio archaeologist Ned Connors digs up sounds and stories from the past for our program. Tonight he brings us the story of an African-American musician from Erie, Pennsylvania, and the indelible mark he left on Dvorak during the great Czech composer's visit to the United States.
The celebrated Czech composer Antonín Dvorak arrived in New York City in 1892 to direct the National Conservatory of Music, an innovative school unusual in that it welcomed deserving female, African, and Native American students. Dvorak, who grew up in Bohemia, had had no previous contact with blacks. In a famous and controversial letter to the New York Herald in September of 1893, he said this of the plantation songs introduced to him by his black students at the conservatory. Negro melodies are the real foundation of any serious and original school of composition to be developed in the United States. In these melodies, I discover all that is needed for a great and noble school of music. His Symphony from the New World, grafting purely American influences onto a European classical form, premiered the same year to great acclaim and considerable debate. One of Dvorak's African-American students, Harry Burley, played a profound role in introducing spirituals to the Bohemian composer. Born in 1866, Burley listened to and learned the sorrow songs sung by his maternal grandfather, a former slave. His mother, despite a college education and fluency in French and Greek, worked as a domestic in the household of Mrs. Elizabeth Russell, who held recitals in her home. Young Harry was allowed to answer the door and listen to the performances. Burley had some musical training in Erie. At age 26, with $30 in his pocket and a letter of recommendation from Mrs. Russell, he auditioned for a seat at the conservatory and received a scholarship to begin his studies the same year that Dvorak arrived at the school. A gifted baritone and pianist, Burley became Dvorak's personal assistant and friend. And during those years in New York, he introduced the spiritual to his Bohemian mentor.
I got a harp, you got a harp, and all the rest of you got a harp. When you get him, I'm gonna play on the harp, I'm gonna play all because him, him, him. Everybody's talking about him, he's going at him, him, gonna play all because him.
As Burley described them, spirituals weren't composed, but sprang into life, ready-made from the white heat of religious fervor, the simple, ecstatic utterance of wholly untutored minds. In this 1916 recording of Heaven, Heaven, the Tuskegee Institute singers evoked the primitive, centuries-old vocal traditions of West Africa. Dvorak was captivated by the melodies and harmonies of the spirituals he learned from Burley, and he encouraged him to transcribe and arrange them for publication. It took a while, but in 1917, Burley published a collection of 48 Negro spirituals arranged in the tradition of the European art song for solo voice and piano. Here's a young Marian Anderson performing Burley's arrangement of Deep River in 1924. Reversal of musical tradition, William Arms Fisher, another student at the National Conservatory, composed what some called a pseudo-spiritual based on the Largo from Dvorak's New World Symphony. He called it Going Home. Here's Paul Robeson live at Carnegie Hall in 1958. Dvorak's belief that African influences would have a profound, defining effect on the future of American music was remarkably prescient. But it didn't happen in classical music as he imagined. In 1917, the same year that Burley published his art song arrangements of Negro spirituals, the Victor Studios in Camden, New Jersey, recorded a little-known New Orleans band then playing an engagement at a Manhattan restaurant, the original Dixieland Jazz Band. African-American influences would come to define American music, but this influence would come from the wellsprings of jazz, blues, and rock and roll. They all have their roots in the plantation songs of sorrow and hope, so beloved of Dvorak and Burley.
I'm going home, the Lord. I'm going home. I'm going home, Lord.
Ned Connors is On Point's audio archaeologist. He lives in Barrington, Rhode Island. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Sisters cry, brother, come home, the Lord. Brother, come home. Brother, come home. Lord, Lord. Brother, come home. I'm going home.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners.